I originally thought I was going to be a civil rights lawyer. That's why I became a lawyer. I started in 62. This was 65. So this was really the height of the civil rights movement. I've led a very privileged life. I feel I owe something. And the only way I can fulfill what I think of my responsibilities is to use my abilities. So that's why I write books. I am 82. It took me 14 years to write the War on Terror books. It took me 8 years to write the Trump books.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Tilting at Windmills. I'm your host, Mike Donahue, and we are fortunate today to be joined by someone. This is the first podcast I've done where I'm actually intimidated by the guest, but with us today is Sir Richard Abel, and I will let you graciously allow me to call you Rick. Why don't you go ahead and let everyone know what your actual title is?
My title is Connell Professor of Distinguished Professor of Law Emeritus and Distinguished Research Professor at UCLA. So the emeritus signifies that I've retired from teaching, which is true. The research professor means that I continue to have an affiliation with UCLA, which I joined in 1974. So now we're coming up to 50 years, and I'm very happy and proud to have that affiliation.
Do they give you anything for that? Do you get a watch or something?
I get an annual parking certificate for $200, which is really a good deal. I don't use it very much, but I get that. I have library privileges. I have the same use of a secretary that I've always had, which is, I think, 1/9. But when I ask for things, they do them. And I still have colleagues whom I interact with, and that's very valuable.
You've had an interesting academic journey. I think you started at Harvard. And then you were at the University of London for a while, and where you got your JD from?
After Harvard, I went to Columbia Law School, and I originally thought I was going to be a civil rights lawyer. That's why I became a lawyer. I started in 62, this was 65, so this was really the height of the civil rights movement. In the summers after each of my law school years, I did work on civil rights, and then after graduating, I went to Mississippi, where I was briefly a civil rights lawyer. Very exciting. But I got distracted. I had a fellowship to University of London, and I spent 2 years in London, and then a year in Kenya doing field work on customary law. And then I started teaching at Yale. And I would have described myself at the time as someone in the newly emerging field of law and social science. That field had just begun to develop at that period. I certainly immersed myself in that. I became an editor of the Journal of the Association, the Law and Society Review, and of president of the association. And I moved to UCLA in 74. I had spent a sabbatical semester in Palo Alto and had fallen in love with California, as people who get a taste of California tend to remain. I had been brought up on the East Coast and never really spent time in California before that. So I was very happy to return and have been here ever since. And my research interests evolved over time. Several of them are relevant to this conversation. First, when I was hired by UCLA in 74, the American Bar Association had just instituted a requirement that all accredited law schools, of which UCLA was one, must require a course in professional responsibility. So they needed another PR teacher. They had several, but they needed another one. And they hired me for that. And I was happy to do that because my social science background made me think that the lawyers in the legal profession would be an interesting area in which to apply social science methods. And I discovered that there was a huge amount of really first-rate research already being done and more being done all the time. So that became my central preoccupation. So that was part of it. The second was that with a growing family, by the time I came to UCLA, I had 3 children under the age of 6, which was by itself a preoccupation, and it meant that I was not going to go to Africa with any frequency, and I didn't for many years. So I moved out of African studies and became more interested in the U.S. and then in the U.K. because I was invited to a conference on what was happening to the legal profession in England. And then, and I'm finally going to come to what has brought me to these current books. Then in 1989, I decided that my children were grown up. The youngest was about to leave for college. I could go back to Africa. And I wanted to look at a country that was experiencing major social change, that was confronting, in effect, a constitutional crisis, the possibility of regime change. I am hopeless at languages, so I could not work in a country that didn't speak English. And if you crossed English with revolutionary potential, there was only one intersection, and that was South Africa. So I went to South Africa, and I was fortunate in being able to make contact with the African National Congress and some of its leaders. I got permission to go despite the cultural boycott because I was going to study the anti-apartheid movement. I was introduced to the lawyers who were involved in that movement. And I visited South Africa four times, several extended visits, and ended up writing a book about the role of law and lawyers in the struggle against apartheid, which came out in 1975. So it came out just after the transition. By that time, Nelson Mandela not only had been freed from prison, but elected as president in the first democratic election in the country. And I was deeply honored to have him write a foreword to the book, because Mandela himself had been a lawyer. He had tried in his early career to oppose apartheid through legal means, and only when that became impossible did he turn to military means, and that's why he was jailed. But by this time, after 37 years in jail, he was free and leading the country. That was an inspiring research opportunity because it had a happy ending. And the lawyers and the movement were inspirational, highly motivated, highly principled. One of the things that Mandela says in his brief foreword is that the reason the transition could be so peaceful was that the ANC had always committed itself to the rule of law and had led people in that direction. And indeed, there's an incident that I read during my stays in South Africa. There was a newspaper called The Sowetan, which was published in the township of Soweto outside of Johannesburg, and it described a meeting in Soweto in which the question was, should people who owned houses be able to sublease parts of the houses, and if so, at what rental rates? And somebody raises his arm in the meeting and is called upon, and he says, "Comrades, we must consult the charter, the Freedom Charter. That will tell us what we can and cannot do," which was stunning because the Freedom Charter was the foundational document of the ANC, but it was not a legal document because the ANC itself was illegal, but it prefigured the kind of constitutional framework that the ANC envisaged and which it in fact put into place, including a Bill of Rights and a constitutional court. As I said, it was an inspiring experience. So that was the years late 80s and early 90s.
If you've been, just keeping it from the South Africa time frame back, one of your bios had you listed or labeled you as a legal anthropologist. And I'm assuming that's just the study of the evolution of law in general?
Yes. So when the movement for social science studies of law began, and it began in the 1960s, I think, primarily in the United States, although there were European counterparts, when it began, it was multidisciplinary. So there were anthropologists, sociologists, psychologists, historians, political scientists, and others. When I was in London, I was studying for a PhD in law, which is a degree that's awarded in the UK, even though not in the United States. And my focus, as I said, was on customary law. And that's what I studied in Kenya. I spent a year in Kenya studying the ways in which customary law was changing in the newly independent Kenya.
Have you gotten to analyze or at least take in different sort of methods of law or applying the law?
The customary law is an oral body of law exclusively. There are no written documents, and it tends to be applied in a very consensual fashion. So traditionally, there is often a group, often a body of elders, who listen to the evidence and then discuss among themselves and then come to a decision. It's often a decision that's intended as a compromise decision. So in many ways, it's a radically different approach to how to resolve disputes. And what I was observing was the ways in which it was gradually becoming Europeanized or anglicized during the early years of independence.
Is that just by necessity?
That's a good question. The newly independent government could do what it wanted, but it was still sufficiently oriented toward the English colonialists that it wanted to create a legal system that would look good to the outside world. So it was in the process of taking people who might have some familiarity with customary law, but probably not a great deal because they were young, not old, and giving them at least a preliminary education in English law so they could try to combine the two.
You've also written about some of the legal ramifications that came about from the Iraq War / the War on Terror. And if I'm just from a 30,000-foot view, so we have domestic United States civil rights, we have South African apartheid, we have the impact of a shift, I would think you would say, a shift in our legal attitudes towards terrorism and conflict. But there's obviously that theme running through it, right? Sort of maybe where the U.S. is misstepping or supporting people who have misstepped and just trying to balance that out. Is that fair? Or do your bit in terms of fighting against what that sort of injustice, for lack of a better word?
Yeah. I have a story. I'll tell the story. It's not a long story, and then I'll stop and see if you want me to continue with along that theme. Okay, so I published the book on South Africa in 95. I then go on to other topics, which we can come back to if you want. And then in May 2004, I'm driving back from the Grand Canyon to Santa Monica. Anybody who's taken that drive knows that it's straight across the desert. It's flat. There's nothing there. It was a Sunday morning. It's a long drive. You can easily fall asleep. So I turned on the radio and got NPR, which had Morning Edition on a Sunday morning. And that was the moment when Seymour Hersh broke the story of Abu Ghraib. It was a very dramatic moment. It had come out in a New Yorker article and in this interview in NPR. That obviously shook many people up, but I had a personal relationship to it because Cy Hersh is my brother-in-law, and I knew him when he broke the My Lai story 30 years earlier. So he's always been a hero of mine and a close relative. And I said to myself, I've got to see how the United States deals with a war on terror, which it's already begun to wage, and how that might differ from the South African experience. And my expectation was, let me just stop. I can explain the differences between South Africa and the U.S. and why I wanted to pose that question. Should I go ahead?
It's great. I'm assuming that the perceived threat, and I'm assuming this would be pre-Mandela's ascension and or pre-full democracy or a more liberal democracy, that as the perceived threat continues to rise, laws are enacted or laws are created that begin to impact what traditionally would have been considered a pure civil right. So as the threat is heightened, the government tries to compensate through legal means?
Justification? That was exactly the question. So we have the attack on September 11th in 2001, just as a matter of coincidence, I was visiting at NYU Law School. So I was less than a mile from ground zero and then experienced the rest of that fall with the smell of the burning towers, which persisted for months thereafter. So you have the attack and you have an attempt to eliminate Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, which fails. And then you have Bush's declaration of war against Iraq, which I've got to say, personally, I was strongly opposed to, and which I think is one of the greatest mistakes that any American president has ever made in terms of the loss of life and cost the United States. That had all happened. And then we get the revelations of what happened at Abu Ghraib. And the question I posed myself was, okay, the United States is in a crisis different from, but maybe as extreme as that in South Africa. It was called an existential crisis, although I don't think that is accurate because, however terrible, and it certainly was terrible, the attacks on the Twin Towers and on the Pentagon were, they did not threaten the existence of the United States. So you have those attacks, and the question was, how was the U.S. going to respond? And the Abu Ghraib showed that the response was to tolerate torture, indeed to encourage torture. And then the question was, so what would happen? What would Congress do? What would the courts do? What would the executive do? And it was that I wanted to study. So from 2004 and 2018, 14 years, I worked on that question. In what ways would the fundamental legal structure and constitutional rights in the United States withstand the pressure to use executive power to win this war in ways that are potentially illegal? And unfortunately, the conclusion I came to was that the law was a weak reed and would do relatively little to control, to limit, to regulate the power of the executive.
And I remember that time, and I remember the whole concept of American torture, which sort of, it would have been anathemic, right? Even 40, 50 years earlier, Americans just don't do that. The other guys do that. But I remember that as a society, it was very easy to find people that felt like, yeah, no, they're bad guys. It's a different kind of war. Too much is at stake. And the general public acceptance of torture, or just like waterboarding is not torture, or enhanced interrogation, that we would certainly, if it was an American person being done to it, we would certainly call it torture. But there was really no shortage of people who are really firmly in favor of it, or at least not negatively viewing that. And in fact, like socially, we had shows like 24 and others that sort of tried to put torture in a better light. Is that how you saw it?
One of the appalling things is precisely that there were so many people prepared publicly to become apologists for torture. John Yoo at UC Berkeley is notorious for that. But I'll give you another example, which I was unprepared for, and I don't think I handled it all that well. I didn't handle it, actually. I gave talks about the two books on the War on Terror after they were published. And one of those talks was to the judges of the Southern District of New York, the federal district judges of the Southern District of New York, which is typically viewed as the preeminent district court in the country. And the judges are highly qualified. So I gave that talk, and there was a Q&A. And during the Q&A, one of the judges stood up to leave, but as his parting shot was, "So, Professor, you say torture doesn't work, but the Israelis use it, and they get very good results, so torture does work. So what's wrong with it?" At which point he walked out. I could identify it, but it's not important. I was blown away that a federal judge would make those kinds of comments and would obviously believe that. And Bush believed it, and you may remember that Trump was asked in the campaign in 2016 about torture, and he said he was in favor of torture. We just should have done more of it.
And yeah, we'll have a whole section on Trump. Especially as that's what your books are about. And just to remind everybody, Rick has just recently released in the third book, a triplicate or a triple set of books. I'm sure there's a trilogy. There we go. A trilogy of books discussing autocratic methods as they apply to Trump in America. Is that succinct enough?
Yes. Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
Yeah. They're fascinating. Only two of them are available for purchase now. I think the third is going to be available March 28th.
Let me just add, the book is available. I know because other people have been able to get it, and it's available from the usual sources, from Amazon, from Routledge, and from bookstores. So they're all three now in print.
So I guess the big question would be, what about the Patriot Act? Have you done any study in terms of that? Because that seems like a real big sort of crisscross.
I do discuss it, although not in detail, in the course of those two books. So the U.S. Patriot Act was seen as this wonderful opportunity to bring into force all sorts of restrictive police measures that conservatives had been wanting to pass for years. And now we had the reason for doing so, namely the defense of our country from a foreign terrorist attack. So the USA Patriot Act was brought into effect. I would just add, however, the following, that the ACLU rose to the occasion, as they have on repeated threats to American democracy. And they brought numerous challenges to the Patriot Act, especially as applied. And most of those challenges they won. So I don't think that, the worst constraint of civil liberties was the rounding up of people who looked Arab. I have to put it as crudely as that, because that's what they looked like. Some of them were Central American or Mexican, but to a New York cop's eye, they looked different. So they were just taken off the streets, they were locked up. And then if they were out of the documentation, as many of them were because they were undocumented, they were kept indefinitely, often in atrocious conditions. Some of them were beaten in detention, and then they were summarily expelled. And at the same time, there was a demand that all people from certain countries register, and tens of thousands of documented immigrants registered, making them fearful of deportation or at least of harassment. So there were wide-scale violations of civil liberties in the wake of 9/11.
Yeah, not one of our greatest moments. And I guess, in fact, America, when you look at America's history in general, we have a tendency to do that, right? When something either scares us or we think it's in our national interest, we tend to move the law to the side a little bit.
Absolutely. One can go back to World War I and World War II and the Korean War and the Vietnam War. All of those were moments when civil liberties and civil rights were curtailed, often quite stringently.
Native Americans, eminent domain?
Absolutely.
So after these, honestly, these topics are all pretty depressing, to be really honest. But apparently you weren't satisfied with those topics. And then now you've taken on Trump and the fears that Trump has created in you and so many other people. Why did you make that decision? You've been writing books for 40 years. You could rest happily on your laurels. What made you take up that torch in regards to Trump?
Okay, absolutely the right question. And it's a question I've asked myself many times. Think basically what happened is this, that the books on the War on Terror were published in 2018, and I gave talks at a number of places, and there was a Q&A, but for the Q&A, people usually have to read the books. Each of these books is 700 pages long, so nobody had read the books, and therefore they couldn't use the books as the basis for the question. So the question that was most often asked was, Professor Abel, you've written a book, they thought of each of them as sequential. You've written a book about the Bush administration, you've written a book about the Obama administration, surely you're going to write one about the Trump administration, because this was in the middle of it. To which my flip reply was, absolutely not. First of all, it took me 14 years, and by that time I was in my mid-70s. Secondly, I said to them, look, Trump is a different animal. I am no fan of Bush, and I'm a qualified fan of Obama, but they, and especially their advisors, more or less believed in the rule of law, and they tried to operate within a legal framework. Trump has made it clear that he doesn't care about any of that, and he's just contemptuous of all the constraints on his power, and therefore a book about Trump does not follow from the other two books. But I'm consulting. And I didn't stop taking notes. And the newspapers are incredible repositories of information. So I kept taking the notes. And in December 2020, when the Trump administration was about to end, I thought, you know something? I think there's a book here. And the question is, why did I write it? And the answer there is very simple. I've led a very privileged life. I've been able to teach. I'm well paid. I've got good health. I feel I owe something. And the only way I can fulfill what I think of my responsibilities is to use my abilities. And my abilities are to amass information, to organize it, and to use it in a critical fashion. So that's why I write books. And I've written many of them, and I continue to write them. So I had originally thought of a single Trump book, and I did present the manuscript to various publishers, and one of them was finally interested, Routledge. But they said, by the way, how long is this book? I said, it's 400,000 words. And they gasped and said, we can't do that, quite wisely. Could you break it up? And that's why there are now three books out and a fourth in process.
And they're not what I would consider big books, I think.
That's right. They're digestible. And especially, even if you look at their length, It's about a third footnotes because I want to make it possible for anybody to go back and check what I'm saying. So I give all the sources that I have used. And as I said, I could not do any of this without journalism. The journalists are indefatigable and they do the legwork and it's often boring and difficult and they're challenged. And I just get to, I wouldn't say I cherry pick, but I get to pick the fruit that they have grown. And it's essential to what I try to do.
Yeah. And again, I think obviously there's been a lot of books on Trump that have been released. I think what I found about, and I only got into the first book, what I found unique was it is extremely detail oriented with specific examples and then footnotes and references to those specific examples. So if those of you out there listening are interested, and it lists a number of sort of Trump grievances, the problems that Trump has in terms of upsetting our norms. But if you're detail oriented and you have any sort of interest in how Trump works legally within the United States rule of law, it's a highly recommended set of books. And you're not going to say that because that was a compliment. So you're
thank you. I appreciate it. And that's why I put it out. I'll give you again one example. Yeah. Again, I was honored to have Representative Jamie Raskin write a foreword to this book, How Autocrats Seek Power. I have a slight personal acquaintance with Jamie and, of course, enormous respect for him. And I had a way of getting this to his attention. But one way in which I connected with him was that when the January 6th committee was announced and he was a leading member of that committee, I wrote to him and I said, look, Jamie, I have notes for this, what I think are forthcoming books. This is now several years ago. Could you make use of them? And I sent him all the notes that I had, hundreds and hundreds of pages. I'm not sure how much use they made of them. But that's why I do this. I want this to be a repository of information both now and for the future. And perhaps even more importantly, I want to point to the forms of resistance, if you like, or defense of basic democratic institutions that have been tried and try to figure out which ones worked and which ones didn't. And some, I do think, have worked quite well, and some have been a great disappointment.
I guess a couple of questions is, do you get the sense, especially with the Trump series or Trump in general, that you're shouting into the wind a bit, that there's a huge segment of the American population that doesn't even want to hear what you're saying, let alone show any sort of interest in it?
Unfortunately, I know that book reading itself is going down. That's part of the problem. But no, you're absolutely right. The polling data, again, is very good and very thorough and very sophisticated. And Trump's core supporters are not interested in hearing any of this. Indeed, he has taken the tactical decision to make all of these legal cases a source of import for him. He constantly invokes them. Either he or his supporters have compared him to Nelson Mandela, which I must say really bothers me, to civil rights leaders, and actually to Jesus Christ. He does see himself as being persecuted and asks his supporters to identify with him. And then, of course, he tries to raise money with that.
See, you've had the fortune of being able to see America over the years, over several decades. And I think, so one of the concerns liberals or people in general seem to have is that you mentioned people not wanting to read or completely gearing what they do consume based on their own personal prejudices. So I guess the question is, because there's this generic sort of thought that we're much less educated, much less informed now than we used to be.
People get their information in different ways. Given my age, you won't be surprised that I'm not on social media. So I don't know that domain, although I read about it. And clearly that is where people get most of their news. It's no longer even Fox News. It is a variety of chat groups and social media. And we know those are echo chambers. That is, each person looks to those that confirm his or her own beliefs and prejudices. And there won't be many occasions on which they will be forced to listen to both sides. Although in many ways I dread the prospect, the presidential debates, and now we know who they will be between, the presidential debates will be the one occasion on which people, if they want to listen to Trump, will have to listen to Biden. If they want to listen to Biden, will have to listen to Trump.
Do you think there will actually be a debate?
Yes, Trump believes he can trounce Biden. He's going to use his body language. You remember what he did to Hillary?
Yeah.
He's going to use his bulk to show that he's tough and Biden is weak. I'm not sure that bulk equates to toughness, but yes, he has plenty of bulk. But it will be a large audience. It will be in the tens of millions, and Trump is like nothing better than an audience. So yes, he will debate.
I will bet you one quarter that there is no debate.
Okay.
That we're going to have the first presidential election in however many hundred years without any sort of debate. And you did something I want to touch on is that you did mention earlier how critical journalists and journalism in general was to your book and your writings. And I think without much argument, we have seen a massive decline in the amount of journalism, and some would say the quality of journalism overall. And that has it's more than just the immediate. It also impacts a lot of things in the long term as well, right?
No, it is highly distressing, and we are losing a great deal. And it is partly the economics, it's partly the attention span. There are multiple reasons for why this is happening. But I will say this, again, it's purely anecdotal. I've gotten two inquiries in the last week, one from USC journalism students and one from ASU journalism students. And I've chatted with them online, and they are well-informed, and they're doing investigative journalism, and they're students, and they don't need jobs yet, and the jobs aren't out there. But the fact that bright, motivated, informed young people are still seeking to go into this field, that's a sign of hope.
Let's get into the non-hopeful things. In regards to Trump and autocrats in general, I would have thought that one of those defenses that you mentioned were the people around him, the supporting cast, whether it's his cabinet, top advisors, Congress, the judiciary, that those act as bulwarks against that extreme behavior or extreme lurches in any one direction. But I think that we have seen, or my opinion is that we've seen each of those fail in their own way as a bulwark against Trump.
Unfortunately, I have to agree with you. Let me start with the courts, because that's what I know most about. And actually, I think I know things that have not been written about elsewhere. So for both the War on Terror books and the Trump books, I did analyses of the ways in which courts responded to executive behavior, to acts that I thought were violating basic laws. In the War on Terror books, I concerned myself with torture, with indefinite detention in Guantanamo, with extraordinary rendition, with eavesdropping, etc. And what I found was that votes of judges in cases concerning those topics divided sharply along the lines of which president appointed them. The difference between the votes of presidential appointees by Republicans and by Democrats were correlations on the order of 0.001. I did the same thing with respect to the cases during the Trump administration concerning the pandemic, concerning immigration, and concerning the elections. In this instance, the correlation was 0.00001. That's a likelihood of a chance result of 1 in 100,000. That's extraordinary. That's extraordinary. And just to contrast it in both cases with the fact that in prosecutions of alleged terrorists during the War on Terror and prosecutions of the January 6th defendants in the District of Columbia courts today, there is no big divide between the judges. So it's interesting that when federal judges are dealing with relatively routine matters as criminal justice, criminal courts, they treat them as other criminal cases and they do the right thing. They find some people innocent, some people guilty. They impose sentences that are reasonable, etc. They don't split along political lines. I'll just add this. There's a lot of focus on the great divide within the Supreme Court, and it is a great divide. It's basically 6-3. But I've got to say that the divide is at least as great in the circuit courts of appeal and in the district courts, which hear hundreds of times many more suits than the Supreme Court does. So I think people ought to pay more attention to what's happening throughout the federal judiciary.
In those regionals, are there 13? I forget, but there's those regional districts have their own sort of assumed biases, right?
I'll give you an example, and others have written about this, and it's very disturbing. There are a few district judges who are situated in rural districts where they sit alone. So if you sue in that district, you know who you're going to get. And surprise, the challenges to the Biden administration have been brought in Texas and Louisiana. And they have won because they knew what the judge was going to do before they even filed the lawsuit. The most recent example of that is a judge in Texas who struck down an NLRB ruling that sought to make gig workers actual employees. But there are numerous examples, and of course Dobbs itself began that way, where they picked a judge knowing how he would rule in overruling Roe v. Wade. The judiciary is being severely compromised, and it's only going to get worse.
So is that part of the overall politicization of almost every part of it? It's a natural thing that now the judiciary is becoming politicized? Or have they always been politicized?
No, on the contrary. It's interesting. In the 1950s, the American Political Science Association issued a report, so it must have been a consensus at the time, saying the problem with the two major political parties, Republicans and Democrats, is that they're too similar and they're not giving people a real choice. Now, 70 years later, hard to believe that that was the case, but it was. And if you look at the way Supreme Court decisions came down during that period, the division was not a mirror image of who the appointing president was. And of course, Brown against the Board of Education is the most notable example of that, that the Chief Justice Warren held it up until he could get a unanimous opinion.
So I think a lot of this, again, in my head, this sort of comes back to the rule of law and the importance that society has some sort of faith in the rule of law. And it really does feel like that's been decaying over the last 10, 15 years, whether it's because of the politicization, whether it's because of just outright attacks on the law. My concern is that without the rule of law, if there isn't a strict adherence, most of the time there's a strict adherence to the rule of law with occasional sort of wiggles, that society itself just is going to have a lot of problems.
I couldn't agree more. I'm in the process, since I'm working on this fourth book, of reading everything about really six cases that are pending or against Trump in the recent years since he left presidency. And there are so many disturbing things about them, but one is that every time he loses, even if it's just a motion, not a final decision, he denounces the judge. He denounces the judge in advance. He denounces the judge during the trial. He does extraordinary things. So here he is. He decides that he's going to attend the New York civil case against him for overstating the value of his properties. So he attends it, and he sits there and he scowls. And then, while the judge is speaking, before the case is over, he stands up and he walks out. And this is a case that's going to be decided by Judge Engoron, because he's sitting without a jury, and Trump doesn't give a shit, if you'll pardon the expression. He is determined to defy him. And then he gets out and he then starts to attack him on social media. He does this, he's done this repeatedly. And his supporters read what he's saying and are convinced that the cards are stacked against Trump in any lawsuit and that the courts are rigged, just as elections are rigged. He thinks anything that he fails at is rigged. And yes, the fundamental institutions of American democracy are being undermined by this constant rant.
And I think there's less of them now, but when I was having conversations with election deniers, you would bring up the fact that it's been in front of 61 different judges across the nation, Trump appointees and non-Trump appointees, and they just say, yeah, no, they've turned against them, or they're in the pocket. There is always that, no matter what you say in defense of the judiciary, it goes out the window because of Trump's rhetoric. I guess that wasn't a question.
Right. Well, I read about anticipatory delegitimation. So when Trump imagines that he might lose in a particular context, then he denounces the institution even beforehand. So he did that in 2016, and he did that in 2020, and he's doing it now in 2024 about the elections, and he does it about Congress, and he does it at the courts. He does it about the police. I mean, he does it about the FBI. It's an extraordinary, it is the ripping down of basic institutions, leaving nothing standing.
If the traditional bulwarks, again, the Congress, judiciary, advisors, et cetera, aren't able to put safeguards in place, what do you think we as Americans should do? Because this is a very real threat, right? There's a very good chance that he could be president in 2025. And we'll see, I think it'll make his first 4 years look like a walk in the park. So what are our options? What is the reason for optimism?
The last recourse and the essential recourse is the ballot box. So clearly the November election is absolutely essential. I'm hoping that, like the 2020 election, turnout will be high because people will realize just how high the stakes are. But there's a real fear that people are so turned off by the political process and disenchanted with Biden, rightly or wrongly, and so willing to listen to Trump's statements that Biden is too old and has been ineffective or worse, that they won't vote. And that, I think, would be a disaster. And it's essential that they vote for Congress as well as the presidency. During Trump's first term, because he did not control Congress, he had to do everything by executive order. And those executive orders, because he had bad lawyers, were badly drafted and illegal and unconstitutional, and so they were struck down, despite the polarization within the judiciary. That sequence might well happen again. And then we would have, again, paralysis for 4 years. And paralysis for 4 years, given the threats that America faces around the world, as well as domestically, would be terrible.
So you've obviously thought quite a bit about our democracy and democracy in general. Do you have any ideas, if you were, again, an autocrat for a day, what changes you might make to better improve our existing democracy?
Yeah, I have a colleague, Rick Hasen, who is an election law expert. I recently went and listened to him give a talk. And there are other great election law lawyers. And they say our election laws are a real mess. They're state by state. They leave far too much to the states. They're badly managed. One thing that the Republicans have been trying to do is to replace bipartisan or nonpartisan election officials with acolytes who will do their bidding in local elections. This is very low visibility stuff. So we do need better election laws, and those have to happen nationally, which means they have to happen through Congress and a president. So that would be my desideratum, but that requires Democratic control of both houses and the presidency, and I'm not confident that that will happen. But you'll remember that there were two attempts to reform election law. There was the Electoral Count Reform Act, which was passed, which will make it less likely that the challenges in the certification process on January 6th. And then there was the second law, which was going to be a much more comprehensive election reform. And of course, the Republicans blocked that. So nothing happened.
Speaking of the electoral vote count, I think there was somebody sometimes said, Americans like their problems to be simple. And I think maybe that's more of human nature than just Americans. But we do have this tendency, I think, to just sort of, when we look at something or when we're told about something, whatever that prima facie content is, that what we see or what we are first past tends to be what resides. And there isn't a whole lot of effort to dig deeper, or is that really true, or to validate that. I think it takes a lot of effort, intellectually, mentally, psychologically sometimes, to keep making those. And I think part of the thing that we're running into in terms of January 6th is that the way it's, you have to spend a lot of time to truly understand exactly what was going on and why January 6th was an insurrection. And there's so many people that say, okay, just because they stormed the Capitol, that's not a coup, or it's not an attempted coup. But what would you say to those people that really don't think January 6th was that big of a deal?
The Justice Department has prosecuted over 1,300 people and gotten convictions in all but two cases. And the sentences have ranged up to 20 years. And as I said, there's been bipartisan behavior across the parties by the judges on the D.C. district. So There really is no question. That's what the January 6th committee did so brilliantly, to show the video footage of what was going on and to have testimony. But the people, the revisionists, are coming back all the time. There was just a report filed today trying to disprove, a Republican report, trying to disprove everything about what happened on January 6th. I'll offer a historical parallel, because I think the point you make is, yes, people want things simple. I grew up in a simpler era. So I grew up during the Civil Rights Movement. And when you saw white police beating black people with their batons on the street, sicking dogs on them in the South, shooting fire hoses at them, standing in the schoolhouse door, barring the election ballot, it was pretty clear. It was, you know, pardon the analogy, black and white. There was really no moral ambiguity there at all. Whereas some of these issues are harder to get your head around. Take immigration. Trump has made demonizing immigrants his central strategy. And Biden has had to say, as he does have to say, we need an immigration policy. We've needed an immigration policy for decades now. So he has to agree. We can't have open borders, but we also can't have what Trump has said we're going to have again, which is family separation. He makes it very clear. You rip children away from parents, and then they'll stop coming. He said that explicitly.
Do you have any thoughts? And I'm speaking in generalistic terms here, but it feels, again, from a very liberal perspective, that Democrats in general try to make things fair, right? See the district mappings that are done by a primarily Democratic panel. They seem very fair, as opposed to, say, the Republican-dominated panels. And in general, it feels like Democrats kind of want things fair, and the Republicans just want to win. And I don't know if that's fair to Republicans, but it certainly feels that way. And I just wonder, is there a way of, quote unquote, winning that battle and making everything fair if you have one side who's just completely disinterested in having a good faith, marketplace of ideas battles?
I don't know the answer to that question. There was an excellent column in the New York Times within the last couple of days by Ezra Klein, which makes exactly that point, that Democrats believe in playing by the rules and Republicans only play to win. And again, you can see examples of this. You look at the language that Trump uses against Biden, but against Democrats in general. It's language that no politician in American history has ever used. And so the degradation of language is something that we have to cope with. There was this recent incident, and I know it's minor and it's only in one place, but it is extraordinarily telling. So in a county Republican meeting in Kansas a couple of days ago, a martial arts group put together a booth in which they dressed a mannequin, a dummy, in a Let's Go Biden t-shirt and a Biden mask, and then they gave people baseball bats to beat it up. And people paid money to do that. That is like enacting lynching in 2024. It's just unthinkable.
And I'm afraid to ask this question, but in terms of America and America over the next, say, 50 to 75 years, are you more optimistic than you are pessimistic? Do we have a chance to turn this around, or have we started the Mass Effect spiral downwards?
That is the most basic question, and I don't know the answer to it. The fundamental problem is that democracy incorporates the possibility of autocracy, because Democrats can vote out of, small d Democrats, the people can vote out of the law all the protections that are currently in the law. The German Constitution has a couple of unamendable clauses, but we don't have those. And we have this totally screwy election system where the Electoral College is a disaster and the Senate is a disaster and gerrymandering is a disaster. So we're working against long odds. But if enough Americans want an autocrat, as people do around the world, the demand for strong leaders in other countries we know is growing. If enough Americans want an autocrat, we'll get an autocrat and he will be able to do what he wants.
That's a depressing note. I will, and you don't have to answer this or speak on this because it's a little bit off subject, but obviously the Israel-Gaza situation, Palestinian situation, is across the headlines now. And I'm just wondering if you see any analogies between the South African apartheid state and Palestinians, whether you feel that that does, Palestinian situation does consider it is by your definition apartheid, or just any sort of corollaries at all between the two?
I'm going to give you a sort of sideways answer, because the question itself is too big, I think. But the sideways answer is that I have long been uncomfortable with the use of words or phrases that are historical analogies. So I don't, much as I am highly critical of Israel's treatment of Gaza and the occupied territories generally, the West Bank, highly critical and strongly sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, I don't think apartheid captures what was and is in Israel. And similarly, although I condemn the assault on Gaza, the 30,000 plus deaths, and now the prospect of widespread starvation, I don't think the Holocaust is the right analogy. Those are unique events, and they deserve to be kept as unique events. And we think we need other language and terms to address these contemporary problems.
I think that's a pretty good answer for a sideways answer. I want to wrap up maybe on a lighter note, if that's okay.
Sure.
So you've attended your professor at UCLA, you've attended Harvard, Columbia, and the University of London. Of those universities, which one is your absolute favorite, and why is that UCLA?
Well, that's a question which I could give you a long answer to, but I'll make it a short answer. I'm actually going to Harvard for a conference, and actually I will talk to the law students there next week, 2 weeks. It's not my favorite institution by any means. I did not have a good experience as a student. I didn't think I got a particularly good education. I taught at Yale. I feel equally strongly that Yale has many drawbacks. The University of London is a bizarre institution. I was actually at the School of Oriental and African Studies, and I had 2 years to read and enjoy the delights of London. I'm very grateful for that, but I didn't learn anything from the institution. My 40 years at UCLA have been an utter delight. I've had good colleagues, I've had good students, I've had good administrators, I've been able to work across disciplines, I've been involved in other schools and departments. Among the institutions I've been associated with, it's my first choice by far.
Excellent. And then something we ask all of our guests at the end of the interview, we ask them, has there been any sort of media that you've come across lately, whether it's music, a book, TV, streaming? Is there anything that you've enjoyed that you think the listeners should know about that they may not know about?
My taste is probably not that of most of your listeners. And so I'll tell you one, but it doesn't actually lend itself to easy listening. I'm a very amateur musician, and I've done choral singing my entire life from a teenager until now. And last night I was at a rehearsal of my local chorus, which is performing the Brahms Requiem in Pacific Palisades in a couple of months. And it's a great piece of music. And that for me is cathartic, to be able to actually produce great music. And I'll give you just one last observation. On 9/11, I was downtown at NYU in Greenwich Village, less than a mile from Ground Zero. My apartment was uptown near Columbia. And at the end of the day, I made my way with difficulty back from one to the other. And I was with my family, which was terribly important. But that was also to be the night of my New York chorus rehearsal. And I thought, to be able to rehearse Bach, that would be the only thing that would allow me to stand back from the horrors of the day. Of course, the rehearsal was canceled, so I couldn't do it. But music is, for me, a place of transcendence and peace, and I recommend it to everybody.
Awesome. Again, Professor, thank you so much for your time. I wish you all the best. I guess I would be remiss if I didn't ask what the next series of books is going to be on.
Like, I am 82. It took me 14 years to write the War on Terror books. It took me 8 years to write the Trump books. I'm not starting another big project. I think I'm probably going to look backwards on what I've done over 50 years and try to make sense out of that and leave it to younger people to look forward.
There you have it. Thank you again for taking the time. We really do appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.